Lock and Talk. I'm your host, Tez, and thank you for listening. Thank you for downloading. Each and every week, we have our special guests, Tony and Schwinn. How are you, Tony?
Yeah, I'm not too bad, thanks. Yourself?
Yeah, good, mate. Good, good. And Schwinn, how are you travelling, buddy?
Doing very well, thank you.
Still travelling around on holidays, mate?
I am. I've just reached Zermatt, and I'm here for the weekend. But before I go out there and shred some ice, I thought I'll join you guys and talk some Arsenal.
Just before we go on some talking some Arsenal, you mentioned something about in a WhatsApp group the other yesterday, I believe, or was it this morning, about where were you with?
I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't know what you're saying.
He's got no idea, yeah, Tony. Yeah. I snobbed the listeners.
I forgot what this was about. Yeah, so I had the privilege of training at La Turbie, which is Monaco's training facility in La Turbie. It's a football field that's carved out of a mountain and is just absolutely gorgeous. So I happen to know someone in Monaco who is a sponsor for the club, and they offered me this opportunity to go meet with some of the players and train with them. So I was there for a good 3 hours, some conditioning, which was just me and a coach, just to see if I can, you know, hold my own a little bit. And then there were a few drills that I did with the players, and I was with them for about an hour and a half with the players. So phenomenal experience. Thank you very much to AS Monaco for, you know, for indulging me and giving me this opportunity.
I envy you, my friend.
It was surreal, I'll be honest. You know, when you mentioned it, I had no idea what you're talking about, because I was thinking of an individual rather than of a collective.
Okay.
But it's just something that fell into my lap and was not planned at all.
And for those who are thinking, shit, did he ask if Lamar was coming? The answer is he didn't go down that path because he wanted to keep it professional. Isn't that right, mate?
Yeah, I didn't want to, you know, be trying to dig things out there. I was focused on what I was doing. I was obviously in company of a lot of footballers that I would, you know, love at Arsenal, including Fabinho. Sidibe was there. Hardim was walking around. So there were a lot of questions and emotions going through me, but obviously I couldn't voice those at that given point.
You got a favorite player then, yeah?
I've always had a favorite player there, Falcao.
Yeah.
I've been a big admirer of him since his Porto days in Atletico. Sorry, he was untouchable. Some of the goals he scored there, I think El Tigre was at his prime, was the best striker in the world. So it was a privilege to, you know, train with him, and, you know, we did the crossbar challenge and some of those quirky things that you do, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, good stuff. Good. Got a life this bloke. Okay, let's talk some Arsenal. Let's get into the game. Tony, your take on the lineup, mate. What was your thoughts when that came out?
It was, I think, in hindsight, looking at it, but it pretty much rested everyone that's going to probably start in the World Cup, apart from Xhaka and Iwobi, but Iwobi needs minutes. So looking at it in hindsight, it kind of made sense. But before the game, I probably expected something a little bit stronger. So obviously when we spoke last week, I said I thought Ozil would play one of the two games, but he's obviously now ruled himself out. But yeah, I mean, it wasn't too wild a lineup. I thought that it'd be Mavropanos and Chambers, and it was obviously Mavropanos and Holding. Kolasinac, I think, picked himself. I mean, you just always expect Hector to play the way it is with us. So I was a bit surprised to see Maitland-Niles at right back, but the rest of the team, as I said, it wasn't a huge surprise, especially when you consider that I think Jack was due to be in the squad, but his missus is very much pregnant, so he was at the hospital with her. So yeah, I think in hindsight it probably made sense, but it wasn't what I was expecting before the game.
Okay, Schwinn, your take on the lineup, mate?
I was surprised. To see Dinos in there. I know Tony wanted to see how he does against Jamie Vardy, but I thought after two games back-to-back, he might get a rest. I was surprised to see Holding in there. For me, the lineup was Mustafi and Chambers to start, But of course, Arsene said in his pre-match presser that some of the players that have played on Thursday and on Sunday are going to get a rest. So Chambers missing out did make sense. I'm not sure why Mustafi didn't play. Wonder what's going on there, whether he was just being safe for the last game. But at this point, you would expect us to field our strongest 11s, and it doesn't really make sense not to.
Yeah, I agree.
Ainsley Maitland-Niles.
Sorry, mate. I thought you're going on then. I was just on Mustafi. I don't understand. I couldn't work that one out myself over Holding. I thought that was a bit of an odd selection.
Yeah, Mustafi and Holding could have been a good pair. Or, you know, if you're going off, you know, players having played the past couple of games and you're just rotating, then I think Mustafi and Holding could have been a decent option. For me, even the left back, there was no backup left back on the bench, which screamed to me early on before the game started, because we've seen Kolasinac having problems in, you know, anywhere after the 60th or 70th minute. So I was looking at the bench and seeing if Kolasinac does have a knock, or, you know, he pulls something, then who comes on? And there was no one on the bench. Of course, that was not the issue, but there were some question marks for me for sure. Of course, I think Jack even traveled with the squad but had to go back, and since then he's had a baby girl. So congratulations to him and his family for that. But all in all, it just seemed to be a very broken squad the way it was fixed up, if I'm honest. It just seemed a lot of pieces just put together without a lot of thought.
Yeah, I don't know whether he's fingers, you know, picking younger players because of, you know, to show the younger players for the new manager next year, like Niles at right back. I think, well, he's played left back, he's played midfield, he's played just about every position you can think of. I don't get it. I really don't understand. Holding's been missing for a couple of games and he came back. Mustafi, as we all know, he's a bit... I'm not his biggest fan. 60-40 is what I type of call the bloke. I would like to see, though, Mustafi go in with Mafropanos, because I almost feel as though, and we'll get onto this next week when we do our ins and outs, I almost feel Mustafi's on the outer, so I'd like to see how Mafropanos would have went with Mustafi as a partnership.
Look, I understand that argument just real quick, that he's trying to give an audition to some of the younger players. But you know what? That's not Arsene's headache. His job is to win games. If that is the logic that he is following of giving some of the younger guys an opportunity, then why wasn't Nelson playing, for example? Like, arguably, he's our brightest prospect, but he didn't feature at all. Of course, the red card plays a factor in that, but he didn't start. So I can understand the argument, but I don't see why that would be the case. You know, you go out there to win football games and not to necessarily give the incoming manager something to think about. That's not his headache.
Just quickly, in answer to your question there, like, when you've got Ramsey, Xhaka, Mkhitaryan, Aubameyang and Welbeck, they're kind of going to be your everyday starters. Iwobi's a bit of a hit and miss. I don't know what's happening with Iwobi next year. None of us do. But that defence is where we've always said we've got problems in that back line. Them four defenders, and you could pick and choose at who's played where and what over the season. Maybe it was time to give Niles a go at right back. Maybe it was time to start Holding. Mafropanos, he's done nothing wrong the last two games. And an interesting one, though, Kolasinac came into the mix on left back. I wondered what was happening with Monreal. So... For me, he wasn't really going for the win. I can't say he wasn't going for the win, but on that back line, he seemed to give young blood a chance.
And I don't necessarily agree with that. I think he did go for the win, despite going a man down. And I think this game is obviously unfair to judge our defense on, including Dino's. I don't think we should judge him off this one game. Just like Tony and I said, we shouldn't judge him off the last two games. You know, the kid needs time. He will make mistakes, and, you know, we don't want his trust to be very low, and we don't want his highs to be very high. Give the guy a chance. I think it was more to do with the personnel before the game started. The rotation, not the personnel in terms of the individuals. I think there was enough quality on the pitch, and we showed that despite going a man down to win the game. But I think the rotation was questionable in my mind. When you have the likes of, you know, more experienced players, why don't you go for the win? Why give these young kids a chance? And even though it's a dead rubber, why not stack up those points and end the season on a high?
I disagree with you there, Schwim, because for me, the result isn't the most important thing at the moment. We're going to finish sixth regardless. And I understand what you're saying about Nelson, but as Tez said, he's not going to be in with a chance of starting next season with the players we have ahead of him. Whereas at the back, at the moment, if we don't sign anyone, just imagine, like, as I said, as we are right now, the back two would be Mustafi and then one of Mavropanos, Holding and Chambers. So for them, it is important to get game time. And I know what you're saying about it's not Wenger's problem, but at least he is looking to the future, because these 3 points, if we would have got them, wouldn't mean anything to anyone. So I personally think he done the right thing in giving them minutes. I disagree with you on that one. I see where you're coming from. But we, as I said, they're guys that have got a chance of playing in the first team or starting next season, especially if they would have impressed. Whereas, sort of irregardless of how good Nelson played, if he did play, I don't think he would be looking at getting ahead of Ozil, Mickey, Welbs, Lacazette, Aubameyang.
And I agree with that. As I said, I see the argument. It's just about giving the new manager something to look forward to, something new to test out. And for me, Nelson gives you that option. I know he won't get a look in into the starting 11, but nor will Niles, arguably. I don't think Holding or Mavropanos are going to start the first game of the next season for as good as they've been. For me, right now, if you had to ask me, it'd be Chambers and Mustafi. So I can see the argument, but I would have rather for us to go for the win and not necessarily give kids an audition, if you will. Don't get me wrong, some of them played really well, but this was before the game started. This was what my feeling was.
I was just going to add, if Jack was fit, I'd imagine we'd see Iwobi on the bench.
Anyone? I think you're right.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like he would have probably given him minutes. I think, I don't know how he would have lined up, but I feel like he probably would have given Iwobi the minutes.
Okay, and I should just rephrase that, not Jack fit, if Jack didn't have a baby on the way. So, okay, let's get in to break this down. So the 14th minute, Leicester go up 1-0, Tony. Who do we blame at fault there, and what was your take on that first goal, mate?
It was just a mess. It got into a massive scramble. I can't remember. Whoever it was that gave the ball to Mavropanos was a joke of a pass. I think it might have been
Holding. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was. And then his clearance was poor. And then from then, whoever it was that headed it back was lost. I don't know who was at fault for or whose man that was, but they completely lost him. And then it's a good finish. But in a way, obviously, 90 seconds later, it wasn't ideal. But in a way, I wasn't too fussed that Mavropanos had made a slight error in lead up to the goal, because them things happen in football, and I wanted to see how he would deal with it. Mm. And I think very shortly after we saw the inexperience showed.
Okay. You agree with that, Schwen?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the goal was a typical Arsenal letdown. We've spoken time and again about how some of our players have been stitched up, and that's exactly what Rob Holding did to Mavropanos for that goal. You know, that's not the pass that you need to make there. Just kick the ball into touch or upfield, or just get it out of the danger area so that your team can get back into its shape. But that was not the case, and we paid for it dearly.
15th minute, Schwinn, we see a red card, Mavropanos. What was your take on that, mate?
As I said earlier, that I don't want to be harsh on the kid, just like I didn't want to overly praise him for the last couple of weeks. Shit happens in football. I think the pass that Niles played was not a very bad one. I think if it's a Koscielny or someone who's a little more poised, experienced, they deal with it. Having said that, I think Dino's brought the ball down well. That's not a ball you expect from your wing back to play to you. And I think he did well to look up and find options, but there just weren't any. I think Iwobi should be doing better there. He should be running back and giving Dinos an option. I think Kolasinac should be doing better there and giving his center back partner an option. What followed was really what shows Dinos' inexperience, because he panicked. Once he saw there were no options, he panicked. And once Kelechi Iheanacho jumped on the ball, then he didn't really have an option. I understand why he did that. Maybe Rob Holding could have gotten to the ball, but I think he panicked and he just brought him down. So this was one of the reasons I'm sure Tony would agree that we were, you know, so slow to praise him, because it's not how you perform passively. It's how you perform under pressure that decides your fate. And as a kid, you will buckle down every now and then. And that's just what we saw. So we should just shrug this off as a moment of inexperience and move on, because this is not going to make or break his career.
Tony?
Yeah, I mean, I actually think it might help him in the long run. After the goal, he had the ball twice, and the first time he passed it and they got a touch, but it still went to our player. It was very similar to the time he got sent off, but the ball still ran through to our player. And then literally 30 seconds later, he's done it again and actually lost the ball. I think when he needs to learn, and it will come with age and experience, that sometimes when you're under pressure, you don't need to play the neat ball all the time, or you can just go back to the keeper and play it safe. And this is what I mean about I wanted to see him rattled, because that's when you see more of a player. It's easy to play when everything's going for you, but it's when you're rattled and you're on the back foot, you want to see how they do. And it's hard. You've got to say he failed that test. I'm not judging him on it, because, as I said, it's his third game and he played 15 minutes of it. So I'm not judging on it, but it's good. He needs them situations, because they're going to happen at some time. And at least if it's happened now, he gets to learn from it. It's a shame that he won't be able to play on Sunday now. But as I said, it's an experience he'll learn from.
I'm not sure.
I would want it if it was the other way, which is probably the fairest way to look at it. So probably. Yeah. But I think there's a lot of ifs. Obviously, the ruling is that you have to deny a clear goal scoring opportunity. There's a lot of ifs. Holding, or there's a lot of buts and maybes. Maybe Holding would have got back. Maybe Cech would have got there. Maybe not first, but very close, and it would have been a 50-50 ball. The distance, he was obviously a long way out. So, as I said, I would want it, but I think it's... I don't think anyone would have argued if the ref gave a yellow.
Okay, Schwinn, you agree with that, or was clear red for you?
Clear red for me. I don't think there's any argument against that. But I do agree there are some ifs, but as Tony said, if it happened against my team, I would be howling for a red there. Holding could have reached the ball, but I think he was a step or two further ahead. And when you're the last man, then you just can't do it. You just cannot give the ref an opportunity to make a decision there. So clear red for me.
I'm a little bit like Tony. When I first seen it, I thought, you're kidding me, aren't you? Like, yeah, they deserve a red. But on a closer look on a replay, it is very like 50-50, isn't it? Like, it really could have won. I can't get up the ref for giving the red, but I probably a little bit too harsh, I thought. I don't know, but yeah, it is what it is, I suppose. Now, 19th minute, Tony, Mustafi came on, Welbeck went off.
Yeah, I was... Obviously, a defender had to come on, because I don't know how much they showed of it on TV, but Granit was filling in at centre-back for the 5 minutes between the sending-off and the sub, and obviously it was never gonna stay that way with Xhaka at centre-back alongside Holding. With the choice of substitution, I wasn't particularly sure if it was the right one, because of you'd imagine with 10 men you're going to be on the back foot more often than not, and Welbeck offers more pace than Iwobi. I think it was out of Welbeck and Iwobi just because of the Mkhitaryan and Aubameyang link up. You're probably going to leave them two on. So, look, there's schools of thought both ways. One, Iwobi needs some minutes more, and probably better with the ball coming to feet. So if we're in tight, congested areas, Iwobi's quite good at keeping the ball in tight areas. Whereas Welbeck's more likely to stretch the pitch, but I'm imagining the school of thought was, Aubameyang can stretch the pitch. So then we'll keep the ball player on. I was a little bit surprised. I can see the logic in it. I was just a little bit surprised by it.
Yeah, I'm with you, mate. I was a bit surprised too. I thought it would have been a Iwobi for Mustafi, but it almost seems like a Iwobi's the golden child, can do no wrong. So, Schwinn, you thought the same, mate, or...
It's always going to be tough at that point when you have to make a decision and take a player off, because when you look at it in hindsight, I thought Iwobi had a decent game. Even before we were down 10 men, there was some decent combination play between Ramsey, Mkhitaryan, Iwobi. Ainsley Maitland-Niles was getting involved down the right flank, and I think there were a couple of tasty, combination plays there as well. So I can see the logic in keeping Wobi, just like Tony said, and it was unfortunate that Welbeck had to be sacrificed because he would have been an asset in the game. But when you look at our options as to who to take off, then there's really not much of a choice. And I think Arsene wanted to hold down the midfield as much as he could so that our defense doesn't get too much pressure and trust in Aubameyang to make those runs, which he did. I thought he tried really, really hard that day. I thought he was very, very good for his team. Didn't work out as well as you'd hope, but he was running all over the place and stretching the field as much as he could. So credit to him for working for his team there.
Tony, we get in halftime, obviously. Boys have a bit of a yak. Come out the 53rd minute, and who scores again? Aubameyang. He scored. Has he scored just about every game he's played?
No, I think it's, is it 9 in 12, I think he's got in the league? Yeah. Something like that. So, yeah, I mean, a very good record. 3 and 4. I mean, you take that across the season. That'd be, what, 26 goals, something like that?
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, you can't knock that. But yeah, brilliant from Niles. A great run to get around Diabate. It was annoying me in the first half because he isolated Fuchs quite a lot. And I know Fuchs is very strong, but he's nowhere near the pace Ainsley has. And Ainsley's also quite tricky. So I was like screaming, go at him, go at him. And he never did. And then the first time he had a go at someone, obviously, granted, it wasn't Fuchs, it was Diabate. But he breathed past them, and he also done brilliantly to pick out that ball. It wasn't just to cross the ball into the area and hope. He picked out Aubameyang. Mm. You'd expect Aubameyang to score the first chance, to be honest. It's a good save, but you'd expect him to score. But fair play to him for being on his toes and picking up the rebound and putting it in.
He never gave up. That's what I
Yeah, it was... Well, it's funny as well, because literally just before that, like I was probably less than 10 seconds before that, the bloke in front of me, obviously I didn't know him, he was like, oh, why is Aubameyang out wide? We need you in the middle. Like, useless, what are you doing out there?
Yep.
And then 10 seconds later, he stuck it in the net. But he's very, as I said last week, he just sniffs goals.
Yeah.
And there was a clip from his first goal last week where he ended up against Burnley, where he obviously ended up sliding in and pulling it in from about 2 yards out. 10 seconds before that, he was like 40 yards out on the right wing as well. So with him, and I know I dig Lacazette out a lot early in the season for taking up them positions, but you're seeing the difference now in that when Aubameyang's in them positions, he busts the gut to get into the box and into the 6 yard box. Where that was my issue with Lacazette was that he wasn't doing that. I had no issue with him being out wide and being 40 yards out. But it was that instinct to get into the box. So with Aubameyang, sometimes you look at him and you think, why are you standing there? But he always seems to get in the right place at the right time. So you can stomach it. And I'm just highlighting that because I don't want to sound like a hypocrite. Because I don't want people to come saying, oh, why didn't you moan at Aubameyang for being 40 yards out?
I'd like to... You talk about how quick he gets there, and he does. He comes from out wide, and he gets in that spot like fox in the box or whatever you call it. I'd like to see him and Bellerin. You reckon he's quicker than Bellerin or not?
I don't know, to be honest. And this may sound weird. When I watch Aubameyang, I don't think of him as like crazy quick.
Mm.
Like obviously we've been spoiled down the years because I mean, like. You never see him out and out leave someone, or very rarely.
Mm.
Like he runs, and he just seems to be a bit quicker than whoever he's running against.
Yep.
But like, I mean, obviously, we say we've been spoilt with Walcott, who used to see leave people by 20 yards, whereas Aubameyang never seems to do that. And obviously, he's known for being quick, and he is clearly quick. I'm not saying he's slow, but I don't see him as with the type of pace that a Hector or a Theo has. So, I mean, I would probably say Hector's quicker. I mean, I would definitely say Hector's quicker. I could be wrong, but as I said, it's just when you see Aubameyang running alongside people, he never takes sort of 10, 15 yards out of them. He beats them by sort of 2 or 3 yards, but he maintains composure with that. Sometimes it's you can't really maintain composure when you're going at full tilt. So maybe he is quicker than he looks, but he runs at maybe 80, 85%, which is still quick enough to beat most players, but it allows him to retain composure as well.
To do the job, and he could be just quicker in the light, you know, that 10 meters, you know, that quick spurt, because geez, he seems to get there quick.
Yeah, I think he runs very intelligently as well. Like as I said, them late runs coming from the right. If you're coming from 40 yards out, the centre back's never going to be able to pick you up. and then they've just got to hope to meet you at the right time, and it's always going to be very difficult. So I think he runs intelligently. In flat out speed, I'm sure he is very quick, but for me, I don't. I think if you put him on a 30, 50, or 100 meter race, I'd fancy Bellerin to win all three.
Yeah, later down the track, we'll get our predictions for next season as well. So not this podcast, but in a couple of episodes where we discuss how many we think Aubameyang will get next season. Okay, Schwinn. Now we're going all right, mate, at this stage, and then the 76th minute. It all comes unrattled. Jamie Vardy.
It does.
In the penalty.
It does, yeah. And before that, I think we had another opportunity to score. I think Kolasinac at the post. It wasn't really a clear-cut opportunity, but we came close to threaten. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that even down 10 men, we didn't sit back and soak in the pressure. We were willing to give Leicester a fight, which is what you want to see from your football team.
Just quickly, because you mentioned that, was that in the time frame? I think it was Ramsey. Xhaka did a, it was on a corner, come in, and Ramsey did have a good chance at a header, but it went straight to the keeper, and I thought, oh, if only. I think that was in that same time frame too.
To be honest, I don't remember. I do have in my notes written down that Ramsey did break once very, very well, and he passed the ball to Mickey, who just couldn't find either him or Aubameyang. I think at that point we were pegged back in our half and we couldn't get out. But once Ramsey jumped onto a square ball, I think he was away and off to the races. But we did threaten. I think your wider point is correct that despite being a man down, we continued to threaten whenever we could. For the first half of the second half, we were quite pegged back, I would say, and we couldn't get out. But every now and then when we got a look in, we definitely tried and make the most of it. And that's sort of what makes the penalty so much more brutal. You know, again, I have to hold my hands up and say it was a penalty. Mkhitaryan does not get any of the ball there. And the instance that comes to mind right away is Hector Bellerin on Hazard earlier this season at the Emirates. When you lunge it, when you put your foot in like that, you have to get the ball, because otherwise you're giving the referee a decision to make. You know, we can debate whether, you know, the referee should be giving that decision or not, but if you give the referee a decision to make, then it's out of your hands. And that's exactly what Mkhitaryan did. He tried to get the ball off, I think it was Damari Gray, and didn't get anything on the ball. So I can understand Graham Scott giving the penalty there.
Clear penalty for you then?
A brutal one, but that's football.
Tony, clear penalty for you?
No, I don't think it was.
No.
But I don't think there was either no contact or so little that... Look, I think people have got to get... people often get confused between... Just because there's contact doesn't make it a foul. It's a contact sport. It's similar to Hazard's one. Yes, he was touched, but is that a foul? Never. Like... I've said this before. If that happens in the centre circle, Damari Gray doesn't go down. The same as if it happened in the centre circle, Hazard doesn't go down in the obviously in the Chelsea game. So for me, I think that just never a penalty. And Graham Scott had an awful game. I'm not blaming the result on him, but he had a horrendous game. And I've spoken about him before. I was with my mate that works on he creates football highlights for different TV channels. I went to the game with him, and he said before the game even started, he works quite often with Martin Tyler, who's the chief commentator on Sky Sports. And he said before the game, when they announced who the ref was over to Tannoy, he said, Martin Tyler hates this guy because he's literally only there to make up the numbers because they don't have enough refs. And he said it's very hard to commentate him because you never know what he's going to give. He just sort of seems to blow the whistle at times because he feels like he has to be involved in the game. I mean, there was one time in the first half, we was 1-0 down, I think, by this time. We had a throw on. Maitland-Niles took it. And I'm not saying we was breaking, but I mean, we had the ball under comfortable possession. And he called us back to retake the throw. Like, when have you ever heard of a throw-in being taken too quickly? And then from that, we lost the ball. Mkhitaryan got tackled. And we was under, like, heavy pressure for 5 minutes because he'd pulled us back for taking a throw on too quickly. Like, that's just, it's complete nonsense. It's just that he wanted to be involved in the game. Like, I don't know if you remember what I'm talking about. I mentally noted it down because I wanted to speak about it, and I've seen a few people online speaking about it since. But it's just like, you don't have to be involved in the game. It's a throw-on. People take throw-ons. it's not like he gave a foul throw. He drew the play back for us to retake the throw on from the exact same position. It was just nonsense. And also the linesman that was on where he was defending first half, I don't think he knew what his flag was for. He wasn't putting it up. He wasn't signaling goal kicks. He wasn't signaling corners. They were both just waiting for the ref to give every decision.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that's why we lost the game, but it was just so infuriating, like the lack of decisions or just getting involved and making decisions just because you wanted to blow your whistle.
Schwen, I'll get your thoughts, mate. Refereeing decisions, did you notice anything?
They were sporadic and they weren't consistent, no doubt about that. I would like to absolve the linesman of some of the responsibility because I thought he gave some very close offside decisions against Jamie Vardy, which were correct, and he correctly spotted them.
In the second half?
And in the first half as well, wasn't it? At least a couple of times?
No, there was one where the cross came in and it flashed over. I think it was Diabate that put it in. And again, the linesman didn't... I don't think he lifted his flag in the whole first half. Even that, so it went out for a goal kick, and it was really annoying me, and it's so basic. He wasn't even signalling goal kick or corner. He was just walking away and letting the ref decide everything. So there was one, the cross came in. Vardy was definitely offside, but the ball went for a goal kick, and the linesman didn't put his flag up. So you can't even defend him and say, I gave offside or he gave goal kick. He just walked off. The linesman that we was defending in the first half and attacking in the second half was honestly, I don't know what he was there for.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you about that. I think that's something that was either missed by me or just not shown on the telly. So I couldn't tell you about that. But I think some of the offside decisions were given well, and I think they were spotted very well in real time. But Graham Scott did have a nightmare of a game. I do remember that Ainsley Maitland-Niles throw in, and you don't often see a referee calling the throw-in to be taken again. That's unheard of almost. Especially when you're that deep in your own half. I think this was close to the bench. It was close to the halfway line. I think Niles was very close to Arson. So I remember seeing him in the frame and him getting very agitated by that. So the refereeing was horrendous. But coming back to the penalty, I agree that this would not be given as a foul anywhere else. And that's why I brought up the Hazard decision. It's forcing the referee to make a decision. Gray was very clever to do that. And the reason that it was given as a penalty is because Mkhitaryan tried to get the ball. And when you get contact, even a little, you know the player is going to go down. It's just a symptom of today's game. So the only way you can make sure that the decision doesn't go against you is to get the ball cleanly, or at least get something on the ball that changes its trajectory so that a referee can see, okay, he got the man, but he got the ball first. And I've always said on this podcast that my coach used to tell me that you're not playing against 11 idiots, you're playing against 14 idiots. And he used to count the refs in that. So you have to play the game accordingly. I don't think Gray was going anywhere from there. Ainsley Maitland-Niles was out there to help Mkhitaryan. And I think in the heat of the moment, Mickey tried to get the ball and got the man as well.
I'm just thinking, Graham Scott, there was a couple of times, it was a Manchester United player, and I don't know if it was Graham Scott who pulled him back on a throw-in as well. It might have been Podka. So it has happened a couple of times.
There's a couple of times earlier in the season, I think it was Pogba. Pogba got called up for a foul throw. That's completely different. It's a foul throw, the other team gets the throw. This instance, Maitland-Niles took the throw, Xhaka had the ball in and around the centre circle, Xhaka or Ramsey, and then the ref blew his whistle to come and take it again. If it's a foul throw and he turns it over and says, now it's Leicester's throw, fair enough, that there's someone breaking the rules. But he's literally called it back for no reason.
Yeah, right. Okay, I must have
missed that. It's not the same as what you're talking about. As I said, what you're talking about is a foul throw. They rarely get given, but yeah, it's a breach of the rules. I remember Tottenham when they played Crystal Palace, I think it was away, Serge Aurier got called up for three foul throws in about a minute. But as I said, that's a breach of the rules. It's not often given, but you can understand what they're blowing up for. I still don't know what Graham Scott blew up for with that instance. And as I said, it is so minor because it was a throw-in on the halfway line. But from that, as I said, Mickey got tackled straight from the throw on. Then Ramsey made a foul on the edge of the box and they had a free kick on the edge of the box. And then literally for 5 minutes, that led to a set piece corner. And for 5 minutes, we was like literally backs against the wall just because the referee wanted to get involved in the game.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Okay. No, that does suck a little bit when that happens because I can see what you're saying. So we're down 2-1, boys. Look, we're still fucking trying really hard. Now, Eddie comes on, Iwobi goes off. It just wasn't enough. That was the 84th minute, and then Mahrez gets a goal. And I must say, it was a really good goal. But that type of nail on the head killed us 3-1, 90th minute, Tony.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's a good finish from Mahrez. It still annoys me, and I moan about this way too often, that I know what players are going to do, so why don't our players? Like, Mahrez is always going to cut in on his left foot there. If he had that opportunity 100 times, 99 of them he's going to cut in on his left foot. So why are at least two of our players falling for it? I mean, you expect them to score from that position, but you can still defend against it better. In terms of the substitution of Iwobi, I'm surprised it didn't happen sooner. I thought Iwobi had a good game, and all we're going to hear about is that shot he ballooned into the upper tier. Well, they don't have an upper tier, but the shot he ballooned from the edge of the area. But on the whole, I thought he had a good game. But he was knackered, and Kolasinac was knackered, and they're playing on the same side. So I was very surprised we didn't see a sub earlier on. Obviously, we didn't really have a replacement for Kolasinac, so I was surprised Iwobi didn't come off earlier. It was also one of the reasons that I was surprised Welbeck went off and Iwobi didn't, because we know Iwobi usually got 65, 70 minutes in him, and that's with 11 men. So I thought, if you know you're going to have to sub him off later anyway, you could do it now. So, I mean, I was a bit surprised it took so long to make the subs. I don't really mind that we conceded, that we're pushing to try and get back in the game and we got hit on the counter-attack. It happens. So, as I said, I was a little bit disappointed with the defending, but they were severely outnumbered, so it's understandable.
Look. We always talk about this, and I for the life of me, I can't work it out. And you make a good point of it, and you've talked about it throughout the season. Is why can't our players work out what Mahrez is going to do? For me, I'm looking at that game, and I'm no expert footballer or yourself, and you've played it, and Schwinn. But if I look at that game, right, I know I'm playing Leicester this week. I'm going to want to know, as a defender, okay, Jamie Vardy, what's he do? Mahrez, what's he do? They're the two players I'm going to be doing a bit of research on during the week. I don't get why our players... I don't know whether they don't or whether video is just not a thing for Wenger or what the story is. But it's happened so many times this season where we've all gone and... why did you not know that? We know that as fans, but you didn't know that as a player. I just can't get it working out. Anyway, so 3-1, not real fair result, Schwinn, but when you get down to 10 men after 15 minutes, mate, it really is a fair result, isn't it?
Yeah, and especially when you look at the two goals that we conceded. I mean, Mahrez's goal was obviously, you know, a very, very late goal, and in a close game, that probably doesn't happen, giving us the benefit of the doubt there. And of course, we spoke about the contentious penalty. So, in theory, I thought we did really, really well, despite going a man down. Just on that Mahrez goal quickly, just to echo your guys' point, I think when Mahrez cuts in on his left foot after that step over, he leaves all three players beaten, you know, holding Mustafi and Cech. You know, that's what surprised me a lot, especially from Cech's point of view. When you see Rob Holding trying to recover and you know, almost going past Mahrez, at that point you have to trust in your defender to make that block if he is going to take the shot on before cutting onto his left foot. But Cech doesn't. Cech tries to make a dive almost to his left, and that gives Mahrez the option of beating all three players. So it does say something about the trust that our goalkeeper has, or lack of, in our defenders, which I found very, very surprising. But when you look at the scoreline, it doesn't flatter us. But I think anyone who's watched the game would understand that and give us the benefit of the doubt. And you could hear that from the Leicester faithful. You know, they were singing. Shout out to our away fans. I thought they were very, very loud. Yes, on Sunday. On Wednesday. Sorry. From the start, I thought you could hear one Arsene Wenger at the beginning of the game. The Leicester fans showed their appreciation for that. We returned the favor, and I thought the visiting fans and of course the home fans got you know, value for their money. So this is what football is all about. And sometimes the result doesn't go your way, but you still walk out as a happy customer.
Tony, before we move on quickly, I heard, and most people know who Mark Bosnich is, Manchester United goalkeeper and Aston Villa. He was talking today about goalkeepers in general. Basically, when he was a goalkeeper, the first thing they're taught is whichever way your left foot is pointed is usually which way the ball will go off the right foot. Now, you look at Cech and I think, how many penalties has he saved for Arsenal?
One.
So, I just, is that right? Is that, like, I'm no goalkeeper, but from what you hear and what people have told you, is that you've heard similar?
No, I think as well, penalty takings evolved. A lot of people actually look at, say, Hazard. If basically keepers guess, they guess the direction.
Mm.
And because of the size of the goal, they have to go slightly before the ball is kicked. So someone like Hazard walks up to the ball as slow as you like and waits for the keeper to go. Mm. I mean, I know a few players I used to work with do the same. And there's players I saw play in League Two, for example, and you'd bank on them to never miss a penalty no matter who the keeper was. Because okay. They would just wait for him to go. They would walk up as slow as you like. They'd take 5 seconds to walk up to the ball. And if the keeper doesn't go, if the keeper stands still, they've got no momentum to move from. Omri used to call it freezing the keeper. He didn't do it from penalties. But he used to say, if you make the keeper stop, then they can only dive off one foot, which means they're never, ever going to reach anywhere near the corner.
Mm-hmm.
So I think penalty-taking techniques have evolved. And also, going down the middle is a lot more common than it used to be. I mean, I remember even when I was like growing up, so in like the mid-90s, penalties went either way. It was very rare a penalty went down the middle. So I think penalty taking has evolved. And I think with penalties, I think Vardy massively gave Cech the eyes. He looked the other way completely and then whipped it across himself.
Mm.
But thinking, I would imagine that his left foot was, I haven't seen it, I haven't looked into it, but I'd imagine that the majority of times your left foot is pointing, or your other foot, depending on what foot you kick with, is pointing exactly down the middle. That's what I'd imagine.
Mm-hmm. No, it's just, it was an interesting discussion today that he was having, and I thought, oh, well, that is interesting, and the Cech saved one penalty, and even going back to Mahrez, like, you know, he's saying basically as a keeper, you know pretty much where that ball's going to go, but it still is a gamble, I suppose, as a keeper. Like, it's a pretty big place you've got to save.
Yeah, I mean, look, that penalty, it doesn't matter. You ain't saving that. It don't really matter what you do. That, in all fairness to Vardy, the thing is with Vardy, he hits the ball hard, and I think when a keeper saves Vardy penalties, which actually does happen, I think it's sort of more luck than, I think it's more the ball's hit you than you've saved it. You can go the right way, but I think the way he hits them, it's just, you have to go early because he hits them so hard, and if you save it, you save it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'd ask for man of the match. We'll go for man of the match, and I don't want to say the worst player, but the player that you were a bit disappointed on for Arsenal, Tony.
The reason I avoided talking about Cech so much during the game is because I actually think he was probably our best player. It's out of him and Aubameyang for me, but personally, I thought Cech, especially in the first half, we could have been 2-3 down with some of the saves he made in the first half.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I do put some of the blame for the Mahrez goal on him, but I think the game would have been dead and buried a long time before that had it not been for him. So I'd go with Cech. Most disappointed in, look, it has to be Mavropanos because he didn't complete the game. And you lose it, a huge factor in us losing that game was being down to 10 men. And unfortunately, it was him that got sent off. I'm not digging him out, and I'm not saying he's awful. And as much as I didn't go over the top with praise when he was good, I'm not going to go over the top negatively when he's not been good.
Mm.
But for me, I have to say it's the most disappointing player in the game.
Yeah. Okay, Schwinn?
I just have to echo those points. I think I completely agree with whatever Tony said. I'm rifling through my notes here, and there's at least four instances where Cech made amazing saves.
Mm.
And he did make more, but these were critical ones where they could have easily scored. There was a Harry Maguire incident right after the sending off. There was Rob Holding versus Jamie Vardy early in the first half. And, of course, Kelechi Iheanacho had a couple of cracks at goal from close by where Cech did really well. If the scoreline wasn't 3-1 and it was 1-1, then it'd definitely be Cech. But I think for someone like Aubameyang to stretch the pitch, to work as hard as he did, especially being a striker that doesn't really get involved a whole lot in the build-up. I thought he did really well for his team, and he worked really hard. So I'll have to give it to Aubameyang there. And disappointing, I don't think there was a single player that I want to mention in this, but if you put a gun to my head, then it has to be Mavropanos. Mm-hmm. And this is not a dig at him, but, you know, just an unfortunate consequence of what happened.
Yeah, I have to agree with you boys, unfortunately. I hate agreeing with you guys, but anyway. Because Cech, he was good. Aubameyang, I'm fucking loving the fact that we got Aubameyang. But Mavropanos, look, red card, you get sent off, you kind of let the whole team down. Yes, I was 50-50 on the red card, but it is what it is. And he'd be absolutely spewing that he's going to miss out next game, because it really give him an opportunity to prove himself for the future. So Mavropanos, unfortunately, red card, probably cost us the game down to 10 men after 15 minutes. Okay, boys, let's get into some questions. If yous are ready.
Of course.
It is always.
Okay. Akon Larson, and I think Tony's already answered this one, but did you guys watch the show on Netflix about Juventus? Good entertainment if you have a few hours on the couch. I actually did watch it. Fell asleep after about half an hour because I just wasn't interested in Juventus, but now if Allegri does come, I might watch it again. So, Tony, if you've said that you are yet to see it, was that you?
Yeah, I'll watch it if and when he comes. I will definitely watch it and probably watch it all in one sitting. But until then, no, not really. And interestingly, I'm not sure when it's coming out, but Man City have got something very similar on Amazon. Have done it. I'm not sure when it's being released. It's easy to release things like that when you've won titles, so I'd imagine it will be coming soon.
Yeah, he says the show gives great insight, gives an impression of Allegri, and is very entertaining. So anyone who's interested in Allegri, Netflix have a Juventus documentary.
It would be, sorry to interrupt, it'd also be interesting to, when the Man City one does come out, to watch them both and see the differences, like how Guardiola works differently to Allegri. Whether or not Allegri does become Arsenal manager, I still think it'd be quite interesting to look at the differences between the two.
Yeah, no, I agree. I like some of these Netflix series and that they're bringing this stuff out on Netflix. It's good for football. A couple of BN specials, they have some good documentaries as well at times. And Hakon says, I believe he's coming. Okay. Okay, sorry, I was just reading that one. Got you, bud. Tez, you call Schwinn a crybaby and a fence sitter, but you don't even know how to pronounce Ozil or Kashlani, so calm down, mate. No worries, buddy. At least you're a good listener, mate, and a loyal listener. So, yeah, and I know it's banter, mate, but you're a good lad, RC. Okay. So just
quickly, RC, yep. RC, you must get in touch with Tez and Tony and make them, you know, convince that it's not me operating a fake account on your handle, because that's what they suspect at this point. So whatever you can do to convince them would go a long way, mate.
A selfie will do, mate. If I don't get a selfie in the next 24 hours after this podcast, I'll hit the old right click and report as inappropriate content, huh? I wouldn't do that, RC. Thanks for listening, mate.
You've been doing that a lot this week, haven't you? Let's not get into that.
Let's just leave that one, boy. Okay, Vish, he's back. Okay, Vishy. Schwinn, given the chance, would you take Mahrez and say William for a total of 100 million and sell Ozil to fund their purchases?
Quickly, no.
I probably asked the wrong bloke, Tony.
I would probably say no, but for me it's a tough decision, because it would fill two positions where we're really in need, and we have people that can play as a 10, not as well as Ozil, but they're capable. Someone like Mickey can play there, but I think at the moment everything's built around Ozil. We know that if Ozil plays well, invariably we win.
Yeah,
I'm saying about the other two, and also it's hypothetical because you wouldn't get Willian off Chelsea anyway.
Yep. Okay. He says, I personally think we played well despite being down a man. Would a more tactical, astute manager would have settled for a draw by bringing on two defenders after 70th minute. I know I'm speaking in hindsight, and that despite being one man down, we could have won it had we had more composure in the goal. Tony?
I don't think we had another two defenders on the bench anyway. Bear in mind, one had already came on. And no, I mean, look, had it been at a time when points were mattered, you could understand that score for it. You have to say after 70 minutes, it probably would have been a good point. But look, points aren't the be-all and end-all at this time of the year. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a chance for players to learn how to play differently, obviously only having 10 men, and to work on other things. I get the point, but I just think this game is not an example of when that should have happened. And as I said, I think the only other defender on the bench was Osei Tutu anyway, as far as I know. So, and if we'd have brought in on, people would have gone, oh, you're bringing on another kid in a time when it's hard anyway, sort of thing.
He says, would Tez cry if Arsenal sold Xhaka to buy Kante? Hypothetical. Well, mate, I probably would cry.
You just become a Chelsea supporter, won't you?
No. But what he's missing though, boys, is Xhaka's worth $220 million. So Kante, you'd get more than Kante. So I'd probably be happy.
No comment.
Twins lawyer, you're fucking kidding, are you? just say it.
not just me, buddy.
Tony's going out, I get on the podcast, so this clear. Okay, MAA Gunner for Schwinn, would you take Toure at Arsenal?
Nope. Old. Wages would be astronomical. I don't know what he would bring in terms of, I mean, he's won titles. He's, of course, been a stellar player for Man City, for Barcelona. He's done all he could, you know, whatever there is to achieve. But I think he'd be lost on our cause. And going forward from here, I don't see us bringing in the need to bring in a veteran for any reason. But mostly it's the wage, if I'm honest.
I think, is he... He's available next season, isn't he? He's leaving.
Yeah, for free. He's on a free. His contract's up. Mm.
So not even on a free? Should?
No, I mean, unless he drops his wage demands to like 80 grand, you know, then I'd consider it. Because he would be someone the players would respect. He knows the league. You know, he could probably take up a, you know, I'm thinking all of this that I'm thinking right now is, you know, the best scenario possible. He could take up a role as a staff member at some point. But I don't know if a new manager would be looking for a player like that. And I would rather focus on building the starting 11 than building the bench, essentially.
Okay. And what about your thoughts, Tony?
No, I mean, look, I think he's been an excellent player in his time, and I think it'd be stupid to doubt that, but pretty much for all the reasons said, wages, I don't think he's capable of playing every week. No, I wouldn't go near him, but that's not because I don't think he has been an excellent player. I just don't think he's that anymore. Also, Schwinn said he doesn't see the need to bring in a veteran. There's one that I would very much bring in who's also on a free. Chiellini.
That's a good shot.
Hard to argue with that. Mm. Yeah, hard to argue with that. He could, and you know, he's someone who could probably slot in into a starting 11, especially with, you know, if it is Allegri who comes in, then that relationship is there. And as a manager, you always want someone in your team who you trust, who you can give the armband to. Well,
it would also give us a captain. It would also give us a captain, which we don't currently have.
Exactly. So Chiellini is a great shout. I mean, I don't worry too much about his age, because he would focus on organizing the defense in a way where, you know, he can counter his pace. Of course, the English game is different than the Italian game, so there, he might be found out a bit. But how much worse than Mustafi can he really be?
Okay. Agreed.
And I'll just apologize. Tony's internet is dropping in and out because that's just UK internet for you. So. and I only mention it because somebody did mention it to us last week, didn't they? okay, AFC. Let's just roll with at Matthew Stern. The people interviewed don't work for AFTV.
That's the answer to something else. Ignore it.
Okay, ignore that. Are you guys... Oh, no, Matthew Stern, he says, are you guys happy that Jack is close to signing a new contract according to the plug? Tony?
I mean, I think my answer on this is pretty obvious.
Once again, I went to the wrong bloke.
Yeah, you definitely did. But yeah, I mean, I said it cost you a lot to replace him. So for me, I think it's a no-brainer. I know not everyone agrees with that.
Schwinn?
I agree as well. You know, Jack hasn't been the brightest this season, but you need players around the club in the dressing room who understand what it means to wear the badge. You know, we've spoken about documentaries just a minute ago, but if you look at any Arsenal documentary, whether it's about a player, about a certain season, all you hear from those people is that we have been ingrained in the Arsenal way. We have been told what it means to be an Arsenal player. And unfortunately, Jack Wilshere is the only player at our club who knows to do that. And I say unfortunately because there need to be more. So if there is someone around the club who understands the weight of the shirt, who can teach younger players, new incoming players, what it means to wear the shirt, then I think it's a no-brainer. And it's not as if that he's only good at that. He's a decent player. He's shown what he's capable of this season, although in brief moments. So for me, it was just a matter of, you know, finding the right wage. And it seems like that is not far off from where we are today.
If people talk about wages and whatnot and how much he's going to cost, and they talk about injuries and Jack Wilshere, or Jack Wheelchair is what we often get. For me, it's a no-brainer as well. I think, you know, he is Arsenal at the moment, isn't he? Like, we've got rid of Chamberlain, we've got rid of Walcott, we've got rid of Giroud. You know, of that last 10 years of Arsenal era, I know we haven't won many trophies, but Jack is still that Arsenal player that I think we need to come to stay for these other players. Shaq is starting to, and I don't want to get on the Shaq thing again, but he knows what it is to be a captain, captain of Switzerland, captain at his other club where he was at. So he knows that what it is. So, but these other younger players like Mafropanus, the Holding and whatnot, they need that Jack Wilshere, I think, to understand what Arsenal is about. And I hope we never lose that, boys. RC, we'll go to Will Swift because he did ask. Look, and we did say Mafropanus deserved his red card. Me and Tony are 50-50. Schwinn said, yes, he's a useless player and I don't want him at Arsenal. He's not sitting on the fence today.
Not going to take that bait.
RC, me again as an Australian-Italian named Schwinn.
Wow. I'm just imagining myself to be an Australian-Italian.
Australian-Italian, I look forward to Allegri hopefully joining the Arsenal. I've always wanted to see some Italians influence on our club, and for the life of me I cannot recall the last time this happened. Quiz: who was the last Italian player we signed? Schwinn?
Ooh,
put you on the spot there.
All I can think of is Vito Manone. Was he Italian? He was, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I think Vito Manone would be our last. Arturo Lupoli comes to mind, only because I thought I saw him play once. So, but that was a while ago, wasn't it? Early 2000s, maybe?
Yeah.
I don't know if there's been anyone ever since Manone in particular.
Yeah, I would probably go with Manone as the most recent. In terms of sign-ins, I don't know, because if we signed Manone, obviously it was as a young player. So I don't think we ever have, but on the whole, Italians don't tend to travel. It's they're big examples, but you look at Totti, Del Piero did venture elsewhere eventually, but he spent the main bulk of his career in Italy. say De Rossi, or you look at, I mean, I know when Italy won the World Cup in 2006, them and Saudi Arabia were the only nations that every player played in their country. And I think that's just what it is with Italy. Players tend to stay there. Obviously, Buffon stayed there his whole career. Chiellini, as far as I know, stayed there his whole career. Bonucci. I just think on the whole, they don't travel. If you look at Italians in the Premier League, we've never had a top-class one anywhere off the top of my head. You say maybe Zola is probably the only one. You look at, like I said, all around, all the top Italian players tend to stay in Italy. I know we had Balotelli.
Who was that West Ham player back in the 90s?
Fuck, West Ham?
Yeah.
90s? Jeez, mate.
Yeah.
Okay, you got me.
Of course, I mean...
But why you guys are thinking...
He was so good, though.
Why are you thinking... Viviano was... we signed him in 2013 until 2014.
He was on loan. He played one game, I think.
Yeah, Manoni.
Paolo Di Canio. Sorry, I was thinking of Paolo Di Canio.
Yeah. Righto. Jeez, can't remember that. 2005, 2013 was him. So, Lapoli, 2004, 2006.
Just to kind of that point, Di Canio, though, was never like a star fritty. He was behind Del Piero, Vieri, Inzaghi. So yeah, look, Di Canio was a brilliant player, but I'm saying the top Italians, which you'd expect at a top team to have the top players, the top Italians very, very rarely leave Italy.
Have we had a top Italian player at Arsenal?
No, I don't think. As I said, Zola's probably the only one that the Premier League's ever had off the top of my head.
It's also a very English thing, isn't it? You don't have...
Oh, yeah, we're the same. Yeah, the English players don't travel either. So I think you could probably, if you say to Italians, the English players that have come here, they'd probably go Gazza and Ray Wilkins. But you're looking back sort of 30 years for the last English players that made an impression. Yeah, so,
Beck abroad.
Yeah, he played abroad in terms of Italy. He only went there for a loan towards the end of his career. But as I said, in general, we don't travel, and we definitely don't travel to Italy. And they're the same. Their players very rarely go elsewhere, or not their top players anyway.
You think if Allegri does come to Arsenal, we might start seeing a change of that, because Wenger's brought in a few Frenchies.
I think Wenger knew a market. Like, Wenger came in, you've got to remember, when scouting was nowhere near what it is at the moment. I don't think the internet existed when Wenger came in, or if it did, it existed in a very basic form. So he knew players that he just knew, and he knew they were good. Whereas Allegri will know players that are good, but everyone else will know about them as well because of the way scouting and the internet currently is. He may try and bring people with him. As I said, I'd be amazed if he came in. I'd be amazed if he didn't at least try and get Chiellini. I don't think on the whole he would go for an Italian overhaul. Someone like, I don't know, maybe Insigne, who's the type of player we'd need, and is someone I personally like, he may try and get in if we're looking for that type of player. But I don't think he'd come in and start signing unknown Italians how Wenger did with French people.
Okay. Matthew Stern asks, Tony, what formation do you want to see our current players in? And would it be the same, assuming we buy CBDM Meyer and a winger? Or Meyer? Is it Meyer or Meyer?
Meyer.
Meyer. And a winger.
It's difficult. Look, a lot of people moaned about the back five earlier in the season. I still think we looked safer with a back five. And at the time, pre-January, probably our players were more suited to a back five in terms of the players we had, because we didn't have an out-and-out winger. We were weak at the back, so just having that extra body in there helped, and it also helped provide width from wing back. In terms of what we play going forward, obviously it all depends on the manager and the signings. Most people will imagine us staying with a four. I've seen some people online this week talk about playing with a back three of three solid centre-backs and having the wing-backs as more attack-minded players, kind of like what we tried to do with Chamberlain. So I've seen people talk about that system with two up top, with Laka and Aubameyang and Ozil behind that, and then a midfield two of, obviously, depending on signings. I don't really know what I would like to see because it all depends on who comes in.
It's a hard question.
In England, we traditionally used to... Oh, it's a very hard question. In England, barring the last 18 months, the whole country is pretty much only ever used to really seeing a back four until Conte came in, which was obviously two seasons ago now, but he didn't change until mid-season, really. We back threes or back fives just didn't exist in England. So I think most English people will naturally lean towards playing a back four of some form. But obviously I'm open to change, and it'll be interesting to see with the players we've got and with the manager we've got how they adapt the system.
Okay. Brad's, or original Brad's, for you, Schwinn. Would you guys go for the expensive, young, talented winger like Martial or Leon Bailey? Or would you go for a less expensive player with high wages like Shaqiri?
The former. I think there's a lot of youth talent out there that can fit in to our squad gradually. I see a problem with us buying a starting winger, essentially, because where would you play them? Who gets left out? So I think long term, we have to find someone who can, you know, grow organically and then challenge for the position. I think the investment would be a little lower as well. I wouldn't necessarily put Martial in that category just because of his price tag. Someone like a Leon Bailey, of course, would probably be cheaper, but still quite expensive. Malcolm as well. You know, I would love for us to buy Christian Pulisic, but he probably would fetch around 90 to 100 million. So that's obviously out of the question. But I think this just speaks to how much youth talent there is that likes to play on the wing. You have Kai Havertz at Bayer Leverkusen, who's a phenomenal talent. Keita Balde-Diao at AS Monaco, who I had the privilege of, you know, sort of training with yesterday. He is so quick. He has blistering pace. So I think there's a lot of potential out there. And with, you know, with Sven on our side, I think we could easily identify even more players and recruit very smartly.
Okay. Hakon Larsson. Fuck that name up all the time. Is the number 10 role, Tony, on its way out of the game? Seems like it's more all-round players in the midfield with defensive and offensive attributes rather than specialists.
Brilliant question.
Yeah, brilliant, and also quite difficult to answer because it all depends how teams set up. A few years ago, everyone was a number 10 and every team played with a 10. And football goes in phases. For a while, there's a shortage of strikers. I remember a few years ago, Wenger saying there's no strikers about. And he was right when you looked at all of the decent strikers were tied down and there wasn't many outside that. And then there was a phase where everyone was sort of a winger, a wide forward, so to speak. And obviously, there was a phase when everyone was a 10. And obviously, you had the likes of, say, De Bruyne and Silva at City. At the moment, there isn't many good 10s about. Which means not a lot of teams are using that system. Would they, if they had a good 10? I would suggest probably. So you can look elsewhere and say, oh, the 10 role's dead because no one else is playing a 10. But is that maybe because they don't have the players to play in a 10? Apart from Man City, who do have 10s in Silva and De Bruyne, as mentioned, and one of them naturally has to drop deeper. And Silva comes from a bit wider, but he still doesn't have to contend with much defending duties, but obviously that's a sign of how good their side is. You look at, say, James at Bayern, and he maybe drops a bit deeper. So more people are doing that. They're having a 10 that drops deeper, but I think Ozil does that quite a lot as well. So for me, I don't think the 10 role is dead. I'd imagine if other teams had an Ozil, they would play with a 10. I mean, Real Madrid often try and shoehorn Isco into their team. For me, they're not as good a team with Isco in it. Although I think he's an unbelievable player. But he plays as a... It's a weird position. It's like a 10, but coming from a bit wide. A bit like Ozil's doing at the moment. When you look at how our formation's laid out, and obviously I know we have problems with formations, but he's listed as playing from the right. So he's like a wide 10, if that makes sense. And I think that role's becoming a lot more common. So as I said, you've got either Silva or De Bruyne doing that at City. You've got Isco doing it. So I think maybe the 10 role has developed, but that's probably more just to do with the amount of players they're about. And I think when people say, oh, Ozil's the best 10 in the world, and you get arguments for and against, but when you look at the list of who he's competed against, there's really not that many players. So I think it's just that, as I said a minute ago, because there's not that many 10s about, the role looks dead. But in 5 years, there'll be 10s everywhere, and people will say, is the role of an out-and-out winger dead? Or I remember, as I said, with strikers, it was when false nine started being quite common, people saying, oh, is the role of a striker dead? It just seems we get players in batches, and at the moment, there's not a batch of 10s.
Now, while you've been answering that question, I've been pondering over this next question by Matthew Stern. Finally, Tezza, who do you love more, Shaka or Tim Cahill? And don't be a fence sitter.
Oh, I love it. Are you guys going to accuse me of having another fake account now?
No, probably.
This has got to be Schwinn, hasn't it? Like, dead set. in answer to your question... I do love Timmy. I'm going to say Tim Cahill.
Oh,
wow. I love unexpected.
I love Tim Cahill. Yep. Sorry, boys.
Would you sell Shaka for 100 million if that meant buying Tim Cahill for 100 million?
Not now, no. He's too old.
Okay, fair enough.
He's too old. No.
Well, I was just wondering, where do you draw the line?
Look, what he has done in Australian soccer or football, Socceroos, whatever you want to call it, he's our best. He's our best player out of Australia. He's our best player for the Socceroos and he went and played for just to get some game time. I can't remember who it was now. A team over there in the lower leagues.
Millwall.
Sorry, yeah. So he went and played over there. Didn't get a lot of game time from what I was reading, but yet he's named in the Socceroos squad because we need him at the World Cup. And he's one of them players that can score us a freaky goal. And with that head of his, mate, let's go, Timmy Cahill. Okay. He's back again. Matthew Stern, a.k.a. Schwinn, false account number 3. Assuming we get 50 million for Ozil, would you sell him to raise funds for the likes of Oblak or says help me out, boys. Who's that bloke plays for Everton?
Ryan Sessegnon. He's a Fulham left back. After reading the question, Tez, do you still think it's a fake account that's owned by me?
No, it's not. This ain't Schwinn. This is not Schwinn.
I have the question pulled up in front of me, and it says 50 million plus. Now, that plus is intriguing to me because I could see an argument for selling him, you know, if it's 75, 80 million. And to be honest, if the current reports of our transfer budget are true of being in the 50 to 60, you know, range, then I wouldn't necessarily count that option out. I don't know if I would invest that money back into players like Sessegnon or Oblak, but if Ozil can bring us that cash injection of 75, 80, 90 million, then I think that's a very, very tempting offer.
Tony, how much do you think Ozil's worth?
I don't know. Look, as we've said, the role of a 10 is dying at the moment. So you've got to look at who would be interested. And I'm not saying he's not a brilliant player. I mean, look, a lot of people criticise him often. I don't really go with that. I think he's an exceptional player. But you've got to think who would be trying to buy that type of player.
I'll butt in and say Mourinho or Manchester United just to annoy the fuck out of us.
Yeah, but then you've got to look at what
fuck himself though.
Sorry, Tony.
Yeah. You've got to look at what they would pay for him. And also, like, we always moan as Arsenal fans about having players and not building. So we moan that we brought Alexis and Ozil and then didn't strengthen and then we get rid of one of them and then we bring Aubameyang in, but we're not growing. You're meant to keep your best players and then bring in other good players to play alongside them. And we always moan about that. But obviously, Ozil's had a couple of bad games, or one, I don't even think it was that bad, but one bad game, and then he's not traveled to the next few. And suddenly it's like, oh, we should get rid of him. And you know, as soon as we get rid of him, it's like, oh, same old Arsenal, up to their old tricks of never adding to their team, just taking one away and putting one in. I think it's just one of them. I don't think there's any chance of it happening, to be honest.
Just, and you make a good point there that we always complain about this and that, but just 2 years ago, Sanchez, Ozil, we were building a team around them. Do you think the Aubameyang was about two, or even Lacazette, was 2 years too late?
Yeah, potentially. As much as I like Giroud, he probably wasn't the best striker to complement the needs of them two players, of Alexis and Ozil. He'd done surprisingly well playing alongside them. Giroud done a lot better than I expected, just because of the type of player he is. But there's no doubt that, especially in Aubameyang, Lacazette to an extent, but especially in Aubameyang would have complemented them two players a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think at that time, you know, we would have probably really... or stamp, yeah, put a spot. Leicester was a fluke that they won the league that year, but I don't know if it was ours to lose either, so like a lot of people did say. Probably was.
That was the summer of us buying just Czech as well, right? Yeah. When we didn't buy a single outfield player.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think it ties in well with that. Just quickly, since this number 10 thing was brought up again, I think there's a key word in Hacken's question that needs to be mentioned, and that's the word role. I think the number 10 role is not obsolete. I think the number 10 position is obsolete because of the way, you know, defenses have to play, because of the golf in class. When you look at the top half of the table versus the rest of the table, more often than not, you will find teams sitting back, which gives you less space between the lines. And that's one of the reasons we are seeing the number 10 role evolve, as Tony said, a number 10 on the right or a number 10 on the left. So I think the key part of Hacken's question is role and not position. Because if he said position, I would say yes, the position is obsolete. But I think in terms of role, it's just evolving. And we like to speak about structures and roles on this podcast as opposed to formations. So I think it's just a point that should be brought up, because that doesn't mean Mesut Ozil is obsolete to us. He can still deliver in different capacities.
And watch Wins talk. And I'm still thinking about this Shaka Tim Cahill thing. If it wasn't a World Cup year, I'd probably say Shaka. So, yeah, anyway. Fucking hell. Don't you hate our question like that just plays on your mind, boys?
So if, like, you're standing and there's a door to your right with Granit Xhaka waiting for a big handshake, and there's Tim Cahill in the room to the left waiting for a big handshake. I say handshake because we're a child-friendly podcast.
Yep.
What room do you go into?
Oh, well,
how you answer that.
I'd say Shaka in that case.
There you go. Question answered.
Yeah, I can probably confuse myself thinking about it, you know. Okay, lads. So Tony, lads, do you think it was more of a result of a circumstances in the game being pushed deep, that we were able to start hitting Aubameyang with long balls, or finally realisation that he's making these runs? I noticed Rambo sending them his way in the first half.
Yeah, look, I think Leicester had to play quite up. Claude Puel's under a lot of pressure, and it seems like he's going to lose his job. His results aren't particularly bad. He's just boring. I mean, he got Southampton to eighth and got sacked just for being boring. And... obviously, now this season, it looks like now they're going to stay up, but they're going to stay up by the skin of their teeth. So I think, especially with us down to 10 men, I think he had to come on the front foot and try and attack us. And then that meant that their defence was going to push up, because it's such an un-Leicester-like performance. Usually, regardless, they sit on the edge of their own box because they know that Morgan especially isn't the quickest. Maguire's not slow, but they obviously, you have to allow for the strengths of your centre-back pairing. But I don't think it's to do with spotting the runs, and especially when you're at games, Aubameyang doesn't runs that sort of threaten the goal. I mean, as I said, I'll bring it up before, but if you look at, say, his last three goals, they've all been late runs into the box, so they're not balls that you can really find him with long. But that game just allowed for it. So I don't think that they're just noticing how he runs more. I just think they know that Aubameyang is quicker than Wes Morgan. So if we get the ball anywhere in behind and the keeper can't get there first, then we're gonna gain 60 yards up the pitch. So I think it was just a circumstance of the game rather than than any sort of new tactical nous or new spotting of his runs.
And Schwinn, I'll go to you, buddy. A question from relatively stupid. Do you like the blue away kit? And if not, would you like to see a return of the yellow?
Yellow, hands down. The Arsenal plays in red and white and yellow and blue. There's no other ways about it. And apart from the fact that that blue kit has brought us no results, it shouldn't have been in the, there in the first place. So we need to make sure that we go back to that yellow and blue.
It's a bloody shit kit, isn't it? Have we won a game in that kit? Not one game, have we?
Europe.
Yeah, but not. Yeah, in Europe.
Sydney FC. We beat them, that was it.
No. Huh? No, that was in...
Hey, was that... Well,
that was in...
Oh, that was in that black and pink one, that's right.
We beat Milan. We beat Milan in blue. We beat Boryslav in blue as well.
That's a shit kit. I don't like that black and pink kit either. I didn't buy that one. I don't like it. Sorry, I just thought I'd add that. question from... Must be a new listener, boys, because we're going to fuck his name up straight off the bat. So we'll give it a go. Sarvesh, 831C. I think that's right.
That's close enough.
Yep, okay. Welcome to the podcast, buddy, if this is your first question and first time, obviously, been listening for a while because you're a loyal listener, I'd imagine. Which defenders would you like to see come in next season, Tony?
Chiellini. Especially if Allegri is our manager.
What you got a hard on for him for?
He's free. It's my favourite price.
Oh, is he free?
Yes.
Oh, well, okay. I'll have the hard on too then.
I think it's more the role he would play, as in a leader that can organise, because I've often moaned that our main defensive issue is organisation. So I think for a free him, it'd probably be on quite high wages, but and only for a short time. I think it'd be a no-brainer. And if we were to buy two, a lot of people would probably answer this with Koulibaly. I'm not massively sold on him. But then what name I would put in that place, I don't know, because I don't feel, and I know me and Schwinn disagree on this pretty much every week, I don't feel we need someone young. I feel we need someone for the here and now. Who that is, I am struggling to put a name to it. So let Schwinn answer and I'll think.
Schwinn?
Well, for the starting position, I'd probably go in for an Alderweireld or someone of that liking. Manolas is of course, another option. Chiellini is a great shout, but there's something about getting a player from Tottenham which would be absolutely amazing. And, you know, we've done that before, and it's a sweet poison, you know, so I'll take that. I'm trying to think of a young right back, someone who can deputize for Hector. And there's not a lot of players that are coming into my mind. I'm not essentially looking for another center back at the moment, because ever since I've said that I would like to bring in two center backs, players like Dinos and Chambers also have stepped up and proven themselves. So if that continues to be the trend, then we may not need another center back. Of course, Mustafi leaving would open another vacancy there, so that's something to keep an eye out on. But we need someone who can deputize for Hector, and there's no one I can think of at the moment. So it's probably something that we can come back to for our season-ending podcast and talk more when we talk about the ins and outs. Maybe we'll be a bit more prepared for then.
Do you have any more that on that, Tony, or you're going to pass till next time?
No, I think Alderweireld's a good shout. One, because he's a good player, but two, because it would piss them off royally. And yeah, Manolas, I've spoke about earlier in the season, that is someone I would quite like. Again, I don't see him as world class, but I don't know if we're in the market or if we're attractive to world class players. I think Toby is probably the best of the players we could get. Look, Tottenham are going to let him go. And they've set a price, which they're willing to accept. The question comes, are they willing to accept that price from Arsenal?
Didn't I see something the other day, Liverpool or something, rumoured for him?
I mean, he seems to want to stay in London. I think he's got kids that are settled in school here and his family's settled here. Okay. So I think that would probably leave Chelsea as the favourites.
Okay. Jonathan Cox. I think this is another new guy. Thank you for your question, Jonathan. And he's just asking, I'll go back to Tony quickly because he's probably the man on this. What's going on with Allegri?
So as far as I know, and obviously I speak to some of the Twitter in the knows quite a lot, and one of my friends was involved with both the Arsenal Foundation and the Arsenal Foundation Ball, sorry, and he was in the director's box on Sunday for the Burnley game. And he said all the talk around there in both events was about Allegri, so sort of from the people that matter. They didn't say it was out and out dumb, but it was all they spoke about. Obviously, all of the Twitter in the know accounts are saying it's all agreed but not signed yet. I'd heard very similar, that he's said he's, obviously we know last year he was very interested in the job, and by all accounts he said he looks like he's agreed to take it this summer. But I never say anything's done until the pen's on the paper, as regular listeners will know. So I think there's an agreement in there, verbal, and it's just finalising that.
What did you make out of his comments after Juventus lifted the trophy the other day? He was talking for the future at Juventus.
Yeah, but then he said, it's weird, he's sort of had mixed messages, because he was talking for the future, but then he said on another occasion, I think it was yesterday, saying that I really hate the negativity around this club, it's not a good place to work, sort of something along those lines. I only saw a clip of it, so I'm not word for words. But yeah, as well, someone did say the other day, well, he's not going to come out when they've still got a league to win and go,
yeah,
fuck this, it's shit, I'm off, I'm going to earn money in London.
Yeah.
I mean, when do you never really hear players or managers saying, even when you know they're done, even when you know they're either leaving or they're joining a new club or whatever's happening, it's very rare that you hear a manager come out and say, I'm off, this place is a shithole.
I don't want to upset my Italian friends and my Italian listeners, but obviously the Premier League's the place to be, and that's where managers of Allegri, and you know, you've only got to look at Klopp in the past, Mourinho and bloody Pep, they've all said that the Premier League is the place to be if you want to be a manager. So at some point, you know, and this is a great test for Allegri, like, you couldn't ask for more of a basket case than Arsenal, could you?
No, well, that's one of the worrying things. If he has said, it's a negative place to work, about Juventus, or he doesn't like the negativity around the club, wait till he has to start dealing with Arsenal fan TV. Fucking hell, he's going to be in for a laugh then.
Oh, yeah. I'm not even going to comment on that. I'm going to get myself into shit. Okay, Schwinn. Shri the Gooner has saying, asked, Wenger has kept saying we only need 2 to 3 players to be competitive for the title. Is he being serious, or is he just him trying to keep the moral up of the players? Moral of the players up.
He's trying to keep the moral of the players up by being serious. I don't think many people would argue that we need more than that. We know Arsene's not a big fan of too many ins and outs, and I've gone on the record and said the same before. But let's be honest, our attack is pretty much sorted. We have to get some steel in our defense and maybe another option in midfield to keep things ticking and keep our opposition on toes. So there's really not a whole lot to be done there. I think Arsene's just saying the truth, and that will automatically keep the morale for the players up.
Fair enough. David, for you, Tony, most certainly, what do you think of the new kit?
Look, I'm not.
And Tony's internet's in and out.
I don't know.
Tony, your internet's sharp as shit, mate, so just start again, buddy.
I'm not a fan. Obviously, I'll buy it and I'll be wearing it to every game next season, but I don't particularly like it.
Okay, Schwinn, do you like it?
Usually, kits will grow on me as time goes on, but I don't think there's any hope for this one.
It's a shit kit, isn't it? Is what we're saying is so that ugly. True? Is that true? Is it real?
It's been making the rounds, and it seems to be the only one making the rounds which is always terrifying. You know, when you have two or three to go off of, then there's some hope. But it just doesn't look real. You know, the colors seem a bit off, and that could just be because of the quality of the photograph. But the sleeves are weird. I don't like those stripy things on the sleeves.
Yeah, they look shit, don't they?
Yeah. Tony was very observant when we announced our sponsorship agreement with BYD, that there was a similar stripe thing going on in the background over there. And, you know, that seems to have been also used here. So that's another reason as to why this could be our actual kit for next year. So, yeah, I don't know. It might grow on me, as I've said, but there seems to be little hope.
About you, Tony, is that the kit, mate? Is that real?
Yeah, as far as I know, as Schwinn said, it's the only one I've really seen. So I would imagine that would be the one we use. So, yeah, I think it is that one.
Okay. Another new listener, I think, or new question, not people, person. Do you think Puma is making bad 2018-2019 Arsenal kits on purpose? Because I haven't seen other teams' kits made by Puma this bad, as bad as ours. I haven't seen many other kits, to be honest, that Puma bought out. You boys, Schwinn?
I haven't, although the rumored away kit for us looks very sexy. I love a dark blue. I mean, I just said that I would like us to go back to a yellow and blue, and I stand by that. But if we are going to get a blue, then that blue one looks very, very nice. I haven't seen kits for other teams. I think Liverpool have announced and Man City have announced, but they don't have Puma. So, but just to go back to the question, I don't think that makes sense for them, because even if they're doing it out of spite, out of potentially losing the contract with us, they still have to... they still have to recover their money, right?
Yeah, yeah. They wouldn't be making shit kits on purpose. No one will.
Yeah. So that doesn't bode well with me. But I haven't seen other team kits, to be honest.
Tony G also asked, do you think that the new manager should take the preseason game serious as to go and win them to create momentum into the season? Or should he use them as a training and see how the players fit into the system we want to play?
We ain't really going to have a pre-season in reality. If any of our players are from a nation that does well in the World Cup, I would suggest probably quarters or onwards, they're not going to get a pre-season. I think, especially under a new manager, I think pre-season's about getting them to work in that system and getting used to the style of playing. And usually, I mean, in general, you either go for charity games in usually Asia, which are all about fitness. That's all they're about. The results are pretty much unimportant. Or you're playing against much lesser sides, and that's obviously a chance to work on your system whilst getting the confidence of results. But as I say, I don't think we really have one. I'm not sure where we're going. I know we've got a game in Ireland, but I'm not sure if we're going to USA, if we're going to Asia, if we're going back to Australia this year. But the vast majority of our players wouldn't be on that flight.
I just had a quick look. So we've got Huddersfield coming up, and then we've got Champions Cup on the 26th of July. Against Atletico Madrid.
Where's that?
It must be in Spa. Hang on, I've looked. Champions Cup, I don't know where it is.
I think we play a game in Sweden, don't we?
I'm not sure. All I know is we've got Man City in Ireland. That's all I know.
Yeah, we've got...
I think we played Chelsea in Sweden, if I'm not wrong.
28th of July, we've got PSG in this Champions Cup, and then Chelsea on the 5th of August Champions Cup. So wherever the Champions Cup is this year, I'm not real sure, but yeah. But other than that, it hasn't got much more on what else there is, boys. So surely we've got to have more than just them couple of games, haven't we?
That should be the case. I'm looking at a couple of lists here as well, and they are contradicting each other, so I'm not sure whether I should talk about these. Arsblog says we are going to play in Sweden, but there's an article by Goal that says we'll be in Singapore playing Atletico and PSG and Chelsea. Oh, never mind. Here it is. But this doesn't mention Ireland, so I don't know what's up with that.
Okay. Now we've got a game. Thank you, for everybody, for your questions. And you can always send us a question at, where are we? At clock end _talk. Jeez, how do I forget that? And the reason, so look, thanks guys for them, because we've had heaps of new ones. Now, I just want to bring up, it's actually funny, I put a little thing out on Facebook yesterday, and it type of gained a bit of traction, just talking about, you know, who for next season and what you do, and it was more of a conversation starter. But I put a little list out just saying that Ramsey would be one to sell next season. So we will actually go into that a bit more depth in a couple of weeks. That was just my opinion, basically, to fund a few. And, geez, didn't I fucking cop it on Facebook? So a lot of people disagree, but it was actually just a conversation starter just to get things happening. So, but I still do. We think we should sell Ramsey maybe to fund a few more players that come in. Huddersfield coming up 2 days' time. Quick prediction, Tony, and line up, mate.
10-0, and Cech, Hector, Nacho, Mustafi, Chambers, Xhaka. I don't know on Jack's child situation. Also earlier, Schwinn said he'd had a girl. I've not seen that anywhere, so I don't know if he has or not. But I'd probably go Ramsey, Xhaka Ramsey. It will be Welbeck, Mickey, Aubameyang.
Okay. Schwinn?
I'd go for pretty much the same, except I think we'll start holding over Chambers, just following this audition suit. Jack did post on Instagram and they've named their baby girl Sienna. So I think that's where I saw it, if I'm not mistaken. But I don't think that should keep him from participating, especially on, you know, the last game of the season, Arsenal's last game in charge. So he might be included in the matchday squad. I'm not sure. If that is the case, then maybe Iwobi misses out. So holding over Chambers and Jack over Iwobi for me. Apart from that, everything stays the same.
Okay, prediction?
4-0 to the Arsenal.
4-0, okay.
Wow.
Yeah, right, you throw me 4-0.
Why not?
I wonder what odds I'll get on that. I'm going to have a look at... I'll pretty much go with you boys on the lineup. I can't predict the lineup if you fucking paid me, so I've got no chance. I am going to go a prediction, though. I'm going to go a 1-1 draw. I think Huddersfield...
Bummer.
I just have this funny feeling on Huddersfield. They got a draw against Chelsea. They are now at a relegation zone. Oh, just quickly before I go, relegation is sorted. Stoke are gone, West Brom are gone, and...
it's not sorted. Basically, Swansea need, a 7-goal swing on the last day.
Them or Southampton.
I mean, the thing is, look, Southampton, I think it's 6 or 7 goals are above them. So Swansea would need to win and Southampton lose by a few. But Southampton have got City, so it is possible. But I can't really see Swansea winning at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yep, okay. So that's good to see Stoke go. No travel down to Stoke, Tony?
Well, yeah, I mean, in terms of the places we're travelling, it's been quite good because West Brom are gone, but Wolves are replacing them. So that's Midlands. Swansea look like going, and Cardiff are replacing them, so it's pretty much the same journey, saving about 30 miles. And then obviously the third relegation place is yet to be seen. The third promotion place from the Championship is yet to be seen. It could be Fulham, which is around the corner, and obviously a hell of a lot closer than Stoke. It could be at its furthest, I'm not sure if it's Derby is probably the furthest, on Middlesbrough, which is a horrible journey. It'd be our second furthest game. But it means you get a night out in Newcastle, which is always fun.
Fair enough. Okay, and just quickly before I go, I have seen who's following us. And just a quick shout-out, obviously, United Kingdom, United States and Australia, top three. Thank you, Sweden, Finland, Norway, Canada, Ireland, South Africa and Singapore. So they're our top 10 followers. Thank you, everybody. For following us, listening to us, downloading and subscribing. We'll be back on Monday for our end of season podcast. and reviewing Huddersfield. We may have a special guest or two. We'll see how we go. And you can follow us at clockend_talk. Thanks, boys. Speak to you soon.
Thanks for having me.
Dankeschön.
Enjoy.